Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathimerini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. Great power rivalry with China has become the central feature of American foreign policy and is playing out across the globe, including in the Aegean and the Balkans. In his latest op-ed for Kathimerini, titled Is America Back?, Andy Zemenidis argues that the United States needs to step up its presence in the region in order to prove that it is back, especially as we look at the U.S.-China rivalry. Andy Zemenidis joins our podcast to make the case that it is imperative for the United States to fully utilize the tools at its disposal, like the DFC, and support emerging partnerships in order to firmly claim the upper hand in the region from Beijing. Andy Zemenidis is the Executive Director of the Hellenic American Leadership Council. Andy, welcome back on The Greek Current.
Hey, Thano. Good to be back.
Andy, in your latest piece for Kathimerini, you raised the question of whether America is really back. To bring America back was a central promise that President Biden made to the American public and to allies during the election campaign last year when he was discussing the U.S. role on the global stage. Looking back over the last year since President Biden's inauguration, how would you describe the U.S. approach to global issues? Are we really back?
Well, the administration started strong, right, trying to reverse some of the retrenchment that happened during the Trump years. For example, entering the Paris Climate Accords, using the right rhetoric. There's definitely an end to the America First rhetoric, but there's other behavior that has left allies concerned. The decision to withdraw and the kind of rapid nature of the withdrawal in Afghanistan was done without consultation, even of our closest allies. And even little things like entertaining the notion of Turkey handling the Kabul airport, that shows, for lack of a better word, some schizophrenia in our being back policy, right? The administration would have only been too happy to dump that on a willing ally. But having Turkey in Afghanistan bolsters Pakistan, which works at the detriment of India, who is a more important ally than ever, given great power competition with China. You had the Australia submarine deal happen in a way that really upset France and the European Union, again, without consultation of a major ally in France who not only had a commercial interest in that deal, but whether they're in the Australia deal or not, they are going to play a major role in the Indo-Pacific. So the rhetoric is good. There is a lot of actions that leave allies believing the United States is not necessarily predictable. And as Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, laid out in a recent piece in Foreign Affairs, the effect of some of these policies is the same effect that some of the Trump policies had, which is America is increasingly alone.
Since the end of the Cold War, it seems the United States has struggled to figure out what the guiding principle for its foreign policy would be. One thing is becoming increasingly apparent, however, and that is that the rivalry with China is taking center stage and is playing out across the globe. How the U.S. meets the challenges posed by China is also a key concern in the Eastern Mediterranean, which is a central focus of your piece. What are the main concerns that you see with regard to Chinese activity in this region?
Well, above all, is that China has extended the Belt and Road Initiative to the Eastern Mediterranean, to the greater Eastern Mediterranean, not only to the littoral states or the states that border the sea. And they were able to do it quite easily because the West at one point didn't even make a play. Let's take the Port of Piraeus as a very pressing issue and the most obvious issue. Greece was forced into an aggressive program of privatization because of the decade of austerity and the economic crisis. The U.S. major Western companies did not even try to get the Port of Piraeus. China has a controlling interest through Costco, and we're not talking about America's retailer Costco, Costco the shipping giant, which also is playing in Haifa port in Israel. China is also playing in a port in Turkey and Istanbul. This is, you know, the Belt and Road is extending to the Eastern Med, and then further up, the Costco facilities are going to be connected to rail facilities and other intermodal facilities that China has been busy buying up in the Balkans. So the fact is, China has gotten a major infrastructure toehold in the Eastern Mediterranean, and we have to be careful that they don't try to turn that into political influence.
Andy, during the Cold War, U.S. leadership, coupled with strong institutions that were designed to protect American allies, were largely successful in neutralizing any of the challenges posed by the Soviet Union. One key success was making sure that the Soviet Union did not gain a significant foothold in the Mediterranean. As we look at the new rivalry that's emerged with China, do you think that the United States is doing enough in this region?
Not yet. The U.S. is conceptually headed in the right direction. They passed the Build Act, which was supposed to be the U.S.'s answer to the Belt and Road Initiative. They created a new International Development Finance Corporation, which was supposed to help counter the Belt and Road Initiative. And let's make a key distinction, because I think a lot of people don't get this, especially overseas. The U.S. is not going to come like the Chinese government, or maybe even like some Arab sovereign wealth funds from the Persian Gulf, and say, hey, we control this state agency and we're going to pour in $100 billion into the Eastern Mediterranean. But whatever the amount of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is huge, right? It dwarfs even what the Marshall Plan was. It is small compared to U.S. capital markets and the capabilities of private investors. But those private investors don't have the flexibility to take a risk in a perhaps unstable situation or in a country where they don't know that the payoff will be immediate. And that's why agencies like the Development Finance Corporation, which in Greece doesn't have to necessarily hand out checks or cash, but can issue political risk insurance, which makes borrowing cheaper for a deal in Greece. The U.S. efforts should be and can be and are authorized to be helpful to private players who want to invest, especially in key areas, infrastructure, energy in Greece. That effort has to be sped up. These institutions, these capabilities were passed into law, they were created, and they're languishing. They're very much on the sidelines. They're not being major players. Some of it is because the Biden team, for internal political reasons here, has not been able to mobilize and staff all these agencies with their people. Some of it is that there are bureaucrats, career bureaucrats, who believe USAID should only be going to developing countries. They're not really focusing on the geopolitical consequences of development institutions being or not being involved in areas like the Eastern Mediterranean. So these are capabilities that the Biden administration has to urgently get up and running and active in regions like the Eastern Mediterranean.
Andy, I want to turn to defense and security issues. This week, we'll see the latest installment of the strategic dialogue take place in Washington, D.C., between Secretary Blinken and Foreign Minister Dendias. What issues do you think need to be addressed, especially when we look at how Greece and the United States can work together to meet the challenges posed by China in the Eastern Mediterranean moving forward?
Well, I think this is a major step in institutionalizing our relationship, going from the one-year MDCA, the previous one, to going to a five-year time frame is going to make it much easier, actually even possible. It may have been impossible before because Congress may not have appropriated funds. They had no incentive to appropriate funds for an arrangement that is here today, could literally be gone tomorrow. The fact that there is a medium-term horizon on this defense cooperation, at the very least, will allow the building of facilities, the building of capabilities, the commitment of resources to lay the foundations for the bilateral alliance of the 21st century. And building those facilities, but also kind of the rhythm of cooperation, the military to military ties, the defense industry to defense industry ties, the intelligence to intelligence ties, is going to be key in what is becoming a major battleground in great power politics.
Andy, you argue in your piece that after complaining over, you know, the last three administrations about allies not carrying their weight when it comes to defense and security, the U.S. should encourage and support emerging regional partnerships and agreements, like the defense agreement that we saw ratified between Greece and France. In fact, last week, we also saw U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan say that Biden was truly willing to support greater European military and defense capabilities. In your opinion, then, is this a sign that we're headed in that direction?
Yeah, I do think that. In fact, today, Politico Europe reported on a statement from National Security Advisor Sullivan, where he said, I think capabilities is the key here, when he's talking about how Europe's defense identity can be complementary to NATO. The France and Greece deal is very much a model. It's increasing the capabilities of two NATO allies, two European allies, two key American partners. And the fact is, we've seen it. We see it in Afghanistan. We've seen it during the Obama years. I point this out in an article. This little bit of retrenchment that we're seeing from America, this is consistent across three administrations. President Obama announced the pivot to Asia, which also meant pivot away from the Middle East. Afghanistan, Trump, all of this is consistent. So the U.S. needs partners that have the capabilities and the willingness to step into where it cannot be. The U.S. will still provide support. It might not be a full naval presence. It may not be there all the time. It may come in, as John Mearsheimer called it, an offshore balancer sometimes. But having this Greece-France partnership, or the 3+1, Israel, Greece, and Cyprus, or the East Med Gas Forum, having those fora where the U.S. can come and support, just as it supported the early European Union when it was just the European steel and coal community, the U.S. provided political and military cover for that early EU. As that Eastern Mediterranean comes together, as a European defense identity starts coming together, it's going to allow the democratic world order to be more capable. And I think, you know, judging by Jake Sullivan's quote, the U.S. is realizing the value of partnerships and agreements like the one that Greece and France just came up with.
Since we're on the issue of security and defense in the Eastern Mediterranean, I want to talk about a recent development, which we also covered on our last podcast episode with Aaron Stein, and that's Turkey's latest request to the U.S. for F-16s and upgrade kits for its Air Force. HALC and a number of other advocacy organizations immediately sounded the alarm in Washington when this news broke, setting the stage for another No Jets for Turkey campaign. What can you tell us about these efforts?
Well, first of all, everybody should listen to that last podcast. I think Aaron Stein did a marvelous job in explaining the issue in just a few minutes. I echo his sentiment that I don't think Washington is going to play his game. And at the highest level, I don't think either President Biden or Secretary Blinken are willing to carry Erdogan's water. Even if they were, the senior leadership of Congress has a hold on this. Even if he was able to manage most of them or convince most of them, I don't know how he gets around Senator Bob Menendez. I don't know how they get around CATSA. And frankly, as you alluded to, there are a lot of civic groups. It's not HALC by ourselves, but there's HALC and the Armenian National Committee, In Defense of Christians, the Hindu American Foundation, American Friends of Kurdistan, the Middle East Forum. And that was just who came together immediately. Civic America in an election year is going to be very gung-ho against this deal. The fact that Turkey did not leak that they're prepared to make any concessions on the S-400 issue or to stop threatening allies and partners with American weapons, I don't see how this goes forward, but it's going to be a priority for us to make sure Turkey does not escape accountability. And frankly, Erdogan, and it seems that most of Washington, with the exception of some apologists who have no caveats, they're backing even Erdogan. But it seems that even the biggest remaining fans of Turkey are making the argument that U.S.-Turkey policy should be premised on preparing for the day after Erdogan. Well, if you're preparing for the day after Erdogan, don't keep giving Erdogan lifelines.
Andy, thanks for joining us with this analysis. Great having you back on our podcast.
Thanks, Thano.
In other news, Greece will increase the number of border guards on the country's border with Turkey, fearing a spike in illegal migration linked to the crisis in Afghanistan. An additional 250 officers will join the 1,500-strong border force over several months. About 800 extra border guard personnel will also be hired to staff airports and regions close to the Greek-Turkish border. On Monday, Greek Migration Minister Notis Mitarakis said a growing number of frontline countries in the 27-nation EU were pressing the European Commission for tougher action to deter migration. Greece, Poland, and Lithuania were among 12 countries that sent a letter to the European Commission last week to call for more extensive EU measures against illegal migration. Finally, authorities on the Greek island of Evia said Monday that more than 200 homes were damaged by weekend flooding, with most of the affected areas left unprotected in the wake of huge summer wildfires. The floods also damaged roads in the north of the island and caused damage on the central Greek mainland. Authorities are racing to clear the damage before more expected severe weather hits later this week. Officials who inspected the damage announced the government will accelerate a 20 million euro program to aid the devastated areas, as local officials pleaded for action. Evia was the area hardest hit by wildfires in August and early September that damaged more than 1,000 square kilometers of mostly forest land in Greece. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.